Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And I'm Colm O'Mungoyne, RTE's deputy foreign editor in Dublin. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all the Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
Over and out, the sensational but not at all unexpected departure of Theresa May, whose tortured premiership literally ended in tears on the steps of No. 10 Downing Street.
I am today announcing that I will resign as leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party. I do so with no ill will, but with enormous and enduring gratitude to have had the opportunity to serve the country I love.
We'll talk to RTE's London correspondent Fiona Mitchell about the death spiral of Theresa May's Brexit career and what next for the Tory party.
And we'll look at how this will go down in Brussels, and also we can take a look back at how she managed the Brexit strategy, how it failed, and how she performed as the interlocutor, not just to the EU, but to Ireland as well.
But first to you, Fiona. Fiona Mitchell, RTE's London correspondent. Another quiet day on the Brexit front.
Yes, very, very little to talk about from Westminster this weather. Yes, quite a week it's been, and unfolded at a rate of knots, even though, of course, Theresa May's leadership has been in question for so long now. But really, I think what did for her was that announcement on Tuesday that she was putting forward a sort of a fresh set of proposals in relation to her Brexit plan, and then she would be bringing it forward for another vote to the House of Commons in early June. Well, the reaction, the front pages on Wednesday morning, even by the standard of some of the vitriol that Theresa May has undergone in the last couple of years, was incredible. And really, from then on, it became quite clear that she was just, you know, on a matter of days, she would have to be very considering where she went from here. She would have to be really laying out the timeline of when she was going to step down.
Why this and
really
why now?
Needed to be very soon.
You know, I mean, there have been difficult periods in the past, and, you know, we've had votes of no confidence before, but why was this the straw that broke the camel's back? What was it that finally did for her?
You know, I think one of the things that gets overlooked in all of this, because we've been so used to the kind of balancing act that's been going on for Theresa May, trying to keep her cabinet on course, trying to keep her MPs on course, all of this with the difficulties that she faces with Brexit. I think one of the things that gets overlooked in this is that very crucial date of June 15th. Now, that was going to be a meeting of grassroots Tory activists, chairmen, local people who are out on the ground all the time helping the party. And there was a sense, a growing sense, that at that meeting, there would be potentially a pretty overwhelming vote of no confidence in Theresa May. Now, that would really be unprecedented. And you have to remember, I spoke to one MP in the last couple of weeks who said to me, he was actually unsure if an election was called, who would go out and campaign for him. And he was in a safe Tory seat. There was a real sense from MPs that they were hearing things at a grassroots level that they hadn't been hearing before. It was a rising din against Theresa May, and they just wanted her gone. And I think as that started to move and MPs started to hear that, there was just a sense of, look, this has to end. And I think Theresa May really started to hear that as well herself. She's been hearing it for a long time from certain elements of her party and also from within her cabinet. But I think once you start to hear it at that grassroots level, there's just no ignoring it anymore.
And probably crystallised by the focus coming on local and European elections, that people were beginning to see the hard reality for the Tory party of the last 3 years and the failure to deliver Brexit.
Absolutely. The rise of the Brexit Party is a real concern for an awful lot of people in the Conservative Party, frankly, also in the Labour Party. There's anger from supporters on both sides. People who voted Leave and don't feel that they have been represented, don't feel that Parliament is doing what it should. Also, people who voted Remain. It may not be happy with the result, but have decided we just have to get on with it. And they now just feel that their entire political life has been consumed by this issue and they can't understand why Parliament can't move forward. So you see with the kind of poll results that you've seen in recent weeks in relation to the Brexit Party surging ahead, a lot of worry about what exactly that's going to mean. And the Conservative Party really starting to feel that and just knew that something had to change. Very little is changing in terms of the maths that is going on in Parliament. Very little is changing around Brexit itself. So maybe there was a sense of change the leader and see if that can give some sort of impetus and push this forward.
And Jeremy Corbyn out today, his reaction to Theresa May going was he had a certain amount of personal sympathy for Theresa May, but that it's now is the time for a general election, he said. Given the results we've seen the Brexit Party getting in opinion polls so far, he has reasons to fear a general election too.
He absolutely does. I mean, there's very little else he can say other than, yes, let's have a general election. But as I say, the concerns about the Brexit Party don't just come from the Conservative Party. They're also Labour Party supporters and voters who, as I say, on both the Leave and Remain sides, just don't feel that they're represented anymore. Talking to people throughout this campaign, you get a sense that sometimes it's a bit of a protest vote. People saying, well, look, we'll vote for the Brexit Party in the European elections and hammer the message home. But also Nigel Farage is now setting his sights on a longer term political realm. He is thinking about how he can transfer any success he has in the European elections into a general election success.
Right.
And that is a real concern for Labour as well.
And it also potentially, Tony, makes it less likely, if it was ever likely at all, that a new Tory leader could secure any concessions from the European Union, because they may, to paraphrase Arlene Foster, treat the Brexit lobby in the UK like crocodiles and say, well, look, if we concede to the Brexit wing of the Tory party, but they don't get everything they want in terms of cake, then we'll just end up dealing with Nigel Farage in the long term. So it may harden European attitudes, this latest phase of developments in the UK.
Yeah, you're perfectly right, Colm. I mean, the EU has been patiently watching events in Westminster unfold, not just recently, but throughout this process. And they have made their calculations, and those calculations are based on the probability of a hard Brexiteer taking over from Theresa May. People here talk a lot about Boris Johnson or Dominic Raab. Because of the way the Tory leadership process is structured, you have a initial runoff of the main candidates before the parliamentary party, but then the final two candidates have to put themselves before the grassroots. And as Fiona has been saying, they are fairly militant at the moment. They have shifted quite far to the right, quite far to the hard Brexit end of the spectrum. They would be fairly relaxed about a no-deal situation. So there's very little time for a new leader to establish themselves with the grassroots before they are confronted with, once again, a huge existential choice for Brexit and for the UK, because we expect the leader to be appointed by the end of July. Then there's an autumn, August break, and then straight into the party conference season, and then straight into a European Council in the middle of October. And at that point, the new leader would have to either say that he or she is heading straight to a no deal, or he or she might ask for a reopening of the withdrawal agreement and the backstop, and that's not really going to happen. Or they will have to seek an extension, but an extension would be an extremely poor outcome for someone who has staked their reputation on being a much tougher negotiator than Theresa May. So we're going to get into a very mucky situation very quickly in the autumn. And I mean, frankly put, you know, people here in Brussels say, you know, if we weren't going to reopen the backstop for someone as reasonable as Theresa May, there's no way we're going to open the backstop for someone like Boris Johnson, because that would be throwing Ireland under the bus, and the bus would come in the shape of a Vote Leave red bus with $350 million a week going to the NHS on it, and Boris Johnson beaming in front or in the driving seat. So those are the kind of fairly stark calculations that people have been making.
Yeah, well, we heard
and it
the
just means that we're going to get, you know, we're going to get straight back into this fairly quickly.
We had the Taoiseach out in Dublin today after casting his vote in the local European elections and the referendum here, saying that personally he felt sorry for Theresa May. He said he had worked well with her on things like nailing down the common travel area, and that there was a real danger for Ireland, that things were entering a dangerous phase for Ireland because of who might take over from Theresa May and the increased likelihood of a no deal. I mean, he did also say there could be a general election and there could be a closer relationship with the European Union, but he was highlighting the danger for Ireland of this phase. Is that a commonly held view in Europe on the broader implications of Theresa May's departure, or has this outcome been priced in from some months back at a European level?
Well, there has been a bit of pricing in for sure, but certainly you do get that sentiment around Brussels and the other capitals at the moment that this increases the likelihood of a no-deal situation. I don't think people are expecting the new leader to march into Brussels, you know, waving a no-deal flag. They will probably make one more attempt to, you know, to reopen the withdrawal agreement. And you do hear this sentiment as well that, well, you know, there's going to be a new commission, there's going to be a new president of the European Council, there's going to be a bit of a reset. That's fertile ground for the UK or for the new prime minister to try and get the Europeans to think again. But that does not really bear scrutiny because ultimately the new leader negotiates not really with Michel Barnier, but with the other heads of government, and you know, most of them will be in the same place as they are now. They'll still be leaders, and you know, after the European elections, where populists and Eurosceptic parties are expected to make big gains, you know, the incumbent mainstream leaders are not going to want to concede to that particular tide on this issue. They're going to want to make sure that, you know, there is no weakening of EU resolve on the overall European project and the principles and, you know, foundational posture of the EU coming to these negotiations. So, you know, I think that's really the mood that you're getting at the moment.
Fiona, what choices will be before the Tory party in choosing a new leader? What's firstly the bare Brexit minimum that will be expected, or is there a wider choice amongst the members? I heard Michael Heseltine out speaking to Sky News earlier saying that there was 5 million Tory voters of a Remain persuasion who were being neglected, but is that going to feature in people's choice at all, or is it just what flavour of Brexit do you want?
Well, there's going to be a wide range of choices because there's going to be a wide range of candidates, Colm, and in order to get their voices heard, people are going to have to come up with different ideas. Now, Michael Heseltine may say there's 5 million Tory voters, but they will not be directly electing the leader. And so, inevitably, anybody who wants to get into that position is, if you like, playing to the gallery that has the power to get them into the office in the first place. The first point that they will have to get over is getting through that runoff with MPs and getting MPs to vote for them. You talk about people like Boris Johnson as being the front runner, but he's not considered to be particularly popular amongst MPs. And there's a sense that, you know, last time out, certainly he really struggled to get the numbers, even before Michael Gove did for him by saying that his friend of many years was simply not fit for the office of leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister. So Boris Johnson has to get over that. Now, there's a sense that there are other MPs who know the kind of grassroots anger there is in the party. And while they mightn't particularly like Boris Johnson, they might also have a fear of keeping him off the ticket because he is very, very popular amongst grassroots Tory members. He is the closest thing they see to Nigel Farage, if you like, in terms of Brexit. And it will be that next point, that 100,000 Tory members who will get to vote on the final two who are chosen. So I think all of the candidates, and they will be many, 17, 18, I think, at the latest count that are expected to declare, all of those candidates will be keeping an eye to both of those constituencies. First the MPs and then the members, and looking at what might be acceptable to them in terms of Brexit. So I think you're going to look at an absolute spectrum of views, and also people having to maybe try and find some centre ground that you don't necessarily expect. People playing up their backgrounds, somebody like Jeremy Hunt, you can expect him to talk about the fact that he was a Remainer, he did support Remain, but he is now wholeheartedly behind Leave. So he'll be trying to say, look, I can see both sides of this argument. But as I say, there's going to be a spectrum of views because there's just going to be such a huge number of candidates.
The prospect of a change of leader, what does it do potentially for the Tory party, or what's the feeling with how much can be salvaged in the teeth of a Brexit party onslaught? The promise of a harder Brexit Tory leader potentially, will it bear any fruit? Is it expected to bear any fruit in that respect?
It depends who ultimately wins out. I mean, we are all expecting it to be a hard Brexiteer, somebody who certainly has a much harder Brexit line than Theresa May. That was always one of the criticisms of her. Oh, she was really a Remainer. Her heart wasn't in this. So we would expect it to be a hard Brexiteer, but they come in with all the same problems that she had. You have the two spectrums of this argument. If you are a Tory who is a passionate Remainer and wants a second referendum, or if you're a Tory who wants to leave with no deal, you are sitting at opposite ends of the line and you still believe that what you want is possible. And it's been that failure to move to the middle and find compromise, the compromise that Theresa May talked about in that speech outside Downing Street. It's been a failure to reach that has made this so incredibly difficult. And the new leader is going to face exactly the same sort of thing. You see it already in terms of the leadership battle. You hear a lot of people talking about the anyone but Boris section of the Conservative Party of MPs who are already trying to block him. All of those kind of difficulties are going to be there. And the numbers problem is going to remain. And the big question is going to be, should they roll the dice and call a general election? Might they, in doing that, manage to claw back some couple of seats in some way to just get over the line? Or if they do that, might they let Labour in and suddenly have Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister and find themselves with the shortest historic record ever as PM? And might a general election allow Nigel Farage in? Or is there some deal that could be done with Nigel Farage if the Brexit Party were to win some seats later on? All of those are big decisions that a leader's going to have to take, and they're really going to have to take them very, very fast.
What messages, Tony, can we expect from Brussels during this leadership contest, or if there is a general election, during a general election campaign? Because there will be presumably or possibly a desire to manage the expectations of the Tory party in choosing the new leader. If somebody says, we'll renegotiate the withdrawal agreement, is Brussels going to be able to keep its silence on that? Or will it make a remark that it will inevitably be construed as provocative and hardline and interfering?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the problem for Brussels, and indeed Jean-Claude Juncker in a recent intervention in Brussels said that one of his great regrets as Commission President was that he didn't jump in and, you know, get down and dirty in the referendum campaign in the UK. As he put it, you know, he would have challenged the lies that were being told back then. But it's a double-edged sword, because the moment the EU intervenes or a commissioner intervenes, you can just anticipate the tabloid reaction in some of the sort of Tory supporting press. So I expect the EU will sit back with their arms folded, you know, sending across the odd volley of, you know, the deal is the deal. We're not reopening it. We will speak to whoever is the main interlocutor of the United Kingdom. So, you know, it's up to you guys over there to proceed. And I can't see them departing from that. Now, you know, once we get into the main finale of the leadership race, you might start to get, more intemperate remarks, depending on, I think, the mood maybe in France. I mean, Emmanuel Macron sees Brexit now as a clear threat to European integration, as a clear contaminant of his particular reform vision of the EU, which is not shared widely across the European Union, you'd have to say. But he's been a lot more forthright in his views about, you know, just trying to get this done, and if need be, just to get the UK out and you know, out of our hair kind of thing. But of course, you have a completely different attitude in Dublin, who, and to a lesser extent in the Netherlands, where they are really worried about a no deal Brexit, and nobody wants to push the UK out if there is a chance that something might change. I mean, that brings us to the whole question of whether or not the UK would seek another extension at the end of October. As I've mentioned, it would be extremely difficult politically for a new hardline prime minister to do that, but again, you're going to face this problem of a House of Commons, as Fiona said, still having a majority against no deal. And, you know, in October, you're going to be getting into the Christmas retail season. And, you know, you're going to hear very loud voices from the business community, from the CBI and so on, the Institute of Directors, saying, please, for God's sake, we cannot possibly have a no deal Brexit. Well, and then, you're going to have a decision by the new Prime Minister as to what to do.
Well, that is the issue, Fiona, isn't it? Much and all, as Parliament is against no deal, the mechanism by which they can block no deal is now less clear.
Yes, and an interesting report out this week from the Institute for Government here in London, essentially saying that not only is the mechanism not clear, but it's not really there at all. It may be that MPs don't want no deal, but the default is, if they can't agree one, then they leave without a deal on October 31st, if, of course, there is no further extension. So, of course, what you'll start to look at is all of the talk that we've had of different kind of parliamentary procedures and ways that things that can be done, votes that can be taken. We've talked about amendment after amendment after amendment. Expect that to come back into play September, October, when they start to see who they are dealing with in terms of a Conservative Party leader. But as it stands, the default is MPs do have to agree on something or leave with nothing. And that is the kind of message that Theresa May has sent time and time again. Part of her frustration, and you could really get that sense from her in that speech. She said, I tried three times, I don't regret it. But I mean, really, the maths, as I say, has not changed for whoever takes over from her. They either have to decide that they are going to try and continue down the route that she did and see if they can find some other way to get that deal over the line, or perhaps they will be somebody who advocates perhaps a no-deal Brexit. Maybe not initially, but maybe saying it's not something we should fear as much as we have been told. So that is something we will only know when we know ultimately who we are dealing with.
Of course, it's not just Theresa May who's changing, Tony. There's also the team that's been the main interlocutors in Brussels, the British perm rep over there and the negotiating team. Can we expect some kind of a shake-up there? Because there was a great deal of unhappiness within the Tory party about the tight negotiation relationship that Theresa May had with her main interlocutor, Ollie Robbins.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really worth just looking back at, you know, why Theresa May has found herself in this position. I mean, you were asking the question at the beginning, like, you know, why now? And obviously, as Fiona outlined there, things just came to a head over the withdrawal agreement bill, and in particular this promise of a vote in the House of Commons for a second referendum. But, you know, she's been treading water and, to mix metaphors, you know, walking an increasingly perilous tightrope, you know, since she started the negotiations in 2017. I mean, things got off to a very bad start because, okay, you had the first sort of 6 months of her premiership. You had a very triumphalist Conservative Party speech in Birmingham in October. Then you had the Lancaster House speech in January, where it was global Britain and we're out of the single market, out of the customs union. Well, we might want some kind of you know, a customs arrangement. We don't really know sure what that's going to be. But then, you know, once they got into the whole process of triggering Article 50 and starting the negotiations, I mean, stuff kind of got real. And the people around her who were shaping the negotiations and shaping the strategy were people like Ollie Robbins, as you mentioned, who'd come from the Home Office. He had a background in Treasury. He'd done some work in Northern Ireland. He had some grasp of Irish issues, but not a huge grasp of European issues. But I think, you know, a lot of pennies started to drop around that time. And then, of course, the Irish issue started to loom large and start to look very complicated. And what she was doing to her detriment was that she was maintaining a very secretive approach, talking to a very small core team of advisors who were, it's fair to say, nudging her towards a softer Brexit, but she was not signalling this to the rest of the party or the country at large, so that when the compromises had to be made and were made obviously in public, there was a bit of a shock reaction from people who were going like, we didn't know she was signing up to this, or how can we possibly have this backstop thing? So there was no preparation done or schooling of the system in Westminster because of her, you know, real failure of politics, a failure of communication, and also you would have to say that, you know, the sheer weight of what she was having to do in terms of extracting the UK from 43 years of membership and try and point the country in the direction of a future trade negotiation and trade relationship and deal with this sudden emergence of this Irish border issue. It's perhaps no wonder that she just couldn't sustain all of these pressures. And I think the problem was that she tried to ride so many horses at the same time, be all things to all people, and it just didn't work.
Fiona, what's the timetable on this now? Theresa May steps down on the 7th. There's supposed to be a leader in place by July, but what steps are taken in that period? How long will it take and what's going to happen?
Well, the official contest will begin on the 10th of June, Monday the 10th of June. And then, as you say, they hope to have a leader in place by the end of July. You can expect numerous different hustings. I mean, I know we've a fortnight to go before it officially starts, but I mean, even already names are coming out from every angle at this stage. Michael Gove, Boris Johnson confirming yet again that he will go for this. Sir Graham Brady saying that he is considering it. Jeremy Hunt telling his local paper that yes, he will be running for the leadership. You know, we know Esther McVeigh, we know Rory Stewart have already said they're going to go for it. We'd expect Dominic Raab. I mean, the list goes on. I could be here all day.
Yeah. It's often the case, Fiona, isn't it, that the front runner in these kind of contests often falls away? Do you think there's a risk for Boris Johnson of that happening?
There's always a risk. There's always a risk for any front runner, and there's particularly a risk for Boris Johnson because he is a little bit of that Marmite candidate. People either love him or hate him. And of course, we saw the last time out in that last leadership campaign how he was one of the front runners at that point and how he was undone very, very quickly in the space of 24 hours, if not 12 hours, by Michael Gove. So there's always the risk of that happening again, and it's suddenly being somebody who becomes almost something more of a compromise candidate, if you like, that suddenly comes a little bit out of nowhere. And interestingly, I think there are lessons to be learned from that last leadership campaign, last time out. We know, of course, what happened with Michael Gove and Boris Johnson. But also, I think there was an interesting lesson in terms of Theresa May, because I've long believed that if Theresa May had had to campaign a little bit more for the leadership, you know, as we remember it, Andrea Leadsom dropped out, and essentially it was the anointing of Theresa May. It wasn't the kind of long campaign that had been expected. It all happened pretty rapidly. But I think if she had had to campaign longer, it might have been that people within the Conservative Party who weren't completely sure of her, knew her from her 6 years in the Home Office and felt they understood her, they might have seen what kind of a campaigner she was, and they might have seen where her weaknesses were, and that might have helped her during that general election campaign. I think an awful lot of the problems that then arose in the general election campaign for Theresa May essentially flew under the radar during that leadership election, because she didn't have to campaign. It isn't her natural, her area. And that would have been seen a little bit earlier on, I think. So maybe there will be people who will have learned from that and want to see the cut of people's jib, not just about leadership, but about how they might actually do if you're then talking about a general election campaign as well.
Would it take, Tony, a general election campaign for the European Union to revise its timelines on the extension to the UK? Because if it's just people attempting to renegotiate the withdrawal agreement and trying to run things to the wire of the October deadline, as you were saying earlier, there is a hardening of an attitude and probably little toleration of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there is going to be an extension to Article 50 again, that would be the third extension beyond October 31st, it would have to be for either a general election or a second referendum. I mean, they're not going to give it, first of all, to allow a Boris Johnson or Dominic Raab or whoever to try to reopen the negotiations. And they probably wouldn't do it either just if they said, well, we need an extension to avoid no deal. I mean, I think that would be a pretty hard ask for the European Union at that point, given that a lot of preparation has been done by the EU to do this. And there's a real feeling that this saga cannot go on forever. So I think those are going to be the main considerations.
So in the near term, you're going to have Ireland asking, you know, questions, money questions about contingency planning for the no deal eventuality, compensation of beef farmers, etc. I see one of the agricultural lobby groups out today already asking aloud what's going to happen with potential compensation for farmers.
Yeah, I mean, that's all going to come back into play. Of course, a lot of those questions were being asked and a lot of that preparation was being done, but then it was all put on ice because we approached the end of March deadline and that deadline passed because we had an initial extension, then another extension. So all of the no-deal stuff kind of got put on ice, but it will all be revived again, you know, as we head to September and, right, of course, October.
When's the next European set piece whereby we'll get a representative idea of what the governments are thinking, what the Brussels bureaucracy is thinking about this potential change? When can we expect the big beasts to react properly and in detail?
Well, we are coming up to a very intense period. As you know, we've got the European Parliament elections happening this weekend. We had obviously the British and Dutch were voting yesterday, being Thursday, today being Friday, the Irish and the Czechs. Tomorrow, the Maltese, the Latvians and the Slovaks, I think, are voting. And then on Sunday, all the other countries. So there's going to be a major big chunk of news and stuff going on next week. We'll have the results of the European elections coming out initially on Sunday night and into Monday. And then we will have the whole very complicated and controversial issue of the Spitzenkandidat process, whereby the Parliament will try and get its ducks in a row very quickly to put forward their nominee for President of the Commission. Then on Tuesday night, the EU leaders will meet to have their first dinner and bite at the cherry on the big appointments coming up, especially the President of the Commission. That'll be the first and most important one. But we could be heading into a bit of a constitutional confrontation between the Parliament and the European Council, the heads of government, over who gets to decide who is the next Commission President. So that'll suck up a lot of the oxygen. And of course, I think fair to say that Theresa May's departure and the leadership race will be kind of hanging around like you know, smoke on a battlefield, you know, in the margins of this. And then in June we'll have the full European Council, the 20th and 21st, I think, of June. There'll be a European Council, and that's really supposed to decide on the big jobs, the President of the Commission. They'll start on the President of the European Council,
right,
President of the ECB as well. All these big jobs have to be filled. So Brexit is still going to take a bit of a back seat, although people people will be obviously
commenting on the fringes,
keeping one, commenting on how things are going. Right. I mean, the leadership campaign will still be ongoing in the UK, so people, you know, leaders arriving in Brussels are inevitably going to be asked, well, what do you think of, you know, Boris Johnson's latest statement, or the fact that he's now way out in front, are you going to be prepared to do a deal with him, etc., etc.? So right. That's how that's all going
to
work.
Okay, before you go back to the jungle, Fiona, finally to you, the results of the European election and the magnitude of the Brexit Party's vote, how much is that likely to play into the Tory Party choice of leader? Is it going to be the person who can out Farage, or will they try and be emphasising a distinct Tory brand in all of this?
It will be getting watched very closely and playing into a lot of people's leadership campaigns without a shadow of a doubt. Also, you can expect next week to see a lot of people lining up to make sure that everybody knows that the reason for any failure that there might be on the part of the Tory party is Theresa May, and she is on the way out. So it's absolutely nothing to do with them, to see here. But after that, expect the next couple of weeks to be full of various different statements from various different contenders. And of course, lots of newspaper spreads in Sunday newspapers and beyond. With people who think that they have a chance of this, possibly relaxing in their kitchens, looking relaxed.
And massive amounts of dirt being dug as well.
Spouses.
Yeah, probably a bit of black ops going on as well. We can expect skeletons to spill out of the closet at a rate of knots as well. Okay, thanks very much, guys. That's it from me, Colm O'Munga, and RTE's Deputy Foreign Editor in Dublin.
And me, Fiona Mitchell, RTE's London Correspondent in London.
And from me, Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe Editor in Brussels. Thanks for listening.